Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
6:13 on this Friday morning, September the 19th. Pleased and delighted to say that the tropics are quiet. It's going to be hot and it's going to be dry. Highs near 90 and no rain really until Thursday. So that grass continues to cease growing, which is good for all of us that have been battling to keep up with it. And then Thursday, highs of 85, so maybe a little bit cooler with a chance for showers, but no real cold fronts on the horizon. It's going to be chilly for those Southeastern Lions in Tiger Stadium on Saturday night. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, joins us now to talk about it. How you doing, Jeff?
Hey, I'm doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I am okay. Let me flip the script here for a second. When a team like Southeastern comes into Death Valley, they're doing this for the payday pretty much?
That's it. I mean, that's the big part of it. $750,000 will go a long way over at the Southeastern Louisiana Athletic Department. And, you know, Frank Selfo, the longtime head coach of the Lions, was joking about it this week, saying, you know, I wish they can just give us the check and we don't even have to show up. But
oh, did he say that?
They will play. There's a lot of kids, though, on that team from Louisiana, and it's a special treat for them to play in the Tiger Stadium. And I know, I think all joking aside, for Coach Selfo, this is just a great experience for his program. They've only played LSU three times, and the first time since 2018. So it's rare to have that opportunity to do it. It's a short little road trip. The game is a sellout, so you know there's going to be a lot of Southeastern Louisiana alums and students and faculty and all that kind of stuff that are going to the game. So it's not going to be a competitive game, but there is certainly interest in the game, and a game for LSU to get right in, and a game for Southeastern Louisiana to make some money and to have an experience for all those players that always dreamed of playing at Tiger Stadium.
I just always wondered how an opposing coach approached a game like this. If you actually say, we can do it, we have a chance to shock the world, et cetera, et cetera. But then when you got the head coach saying, I wish they could just write us the check, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a huge moment, a pregame speech that Coach Selfo is going to deliver before the game. I don't think you're going to get that out of him. I think this is a game that I think what you want to go into when you're a huge underdog or an FCS team going up against an FBS team is, I think the biggest thing, you just want to play a clean game, right? You don't want to go into the game and commit, you know, 8 or 10 penalties and commit 3 or 4 turnovers. I think you know that offensively, LSU should be able to hit on some big plays. It's just that they have more talent than Southeastern Louisiana. And obviously the other thing, with this being the last non-conference game for Southeastern, you want to come out of this thing injury-free. You don't want any big-time injuries or anything like that. Get the experience, get the paycheck, and then move on to Southland play, where Southeastern is a team that's expected to challenge for a conference championship.
And nobody's trying to be, somebody texted in, nobody's trying to be disrespectful of Southeastern Louisiana. We're going by what the coach of Southeastern said. But keep in mind, from LSU's standpoint, too, and I'm getting that in a second with Brian Kelly, if you think you're going to go out there and just show up and they're going to hand the win to you, that's a good way to get you behind, beat, and the world would be shocked, right?
Well, I think there's a lot of motivation here for LSU to play well. One, first of all, the offense hasn't played that great so far this season. So this is the perfect game with six straight conference games coming up after this one for the offense to find some sort of rhythm, for Garrett Nussmeier to connect on some passes, maybe a couple deep passes, for this running game to finally get going, for this offensive line to gel some more. There's just a lot of reasons for LSU to go into this game focused and ready to play. I would think even on defense, you have a defense that's starting to develop a mentality, starting to play with some swag and intensity, and you want to continue to keep doing that as well. So I think there's just a lot of motivation for LSU to go out there and put a good performance on, and hopefully this is a game for LSU's perspective that, you know, by the time the end of the third quarter is rolling around, you're playing a lot of guys that a lot of youngsters and getting a lot of guys some experience and a chance to, you know, some of the guys, freshmen, second string, third stringers, to really get out there and play.
We don't know what we don't know about Garrett Nussmeier and his stomach, but abdomen, whatever the problem is. I guess that's up to the training staff and the doctors. You don't want to do anything that aggravates it anymore. You do want to get him some work and get the offense to click. That's going to be a balance that Brian Kelly, the trainers, and everybody else you have to navigate, right?
Well, listening to Brian Kelly yesterday, he said that Nussmeier had his best week of practice in a while. So he said earlier in the week that Nussmeier's on the other side of this thing. So he said that Nussmeier's feeling really good. And, you know, he was, I think it was the first question yesterday when he met with reporters, you know, what's the balancing act of wanting to give Nussmeier rest as opposed to having him play in this game? And, you know, without hesitation, Kelly said he's going to play because he's feeling really good and he's starting to be able to do some things that he hasn't been able to do the last couple weeks and probably make some throws that he hasn't been able to make over the last few weeks. And they want to put that in a game-like setting. They want to see how he performs in a game-like setting instead of practice. So I think they look at this as the perfect opportunity for Nussmeier to go out there, throw three or four touchdown passes, throw for 250 yards or something like that in a short amount of time, and then get him out of the game. And hopefully he's watching from the sidelines for much of the fourth quarter. I think they feel like this is a chance for this offense to really feel good about itself and some guys to put up some numbers individually. And that's the kind of momentum that they're looking for going into next week's game at Ole Miss.
Ideally, you would like to see them keep it kind of basic. Don't show a lot, although they do have some stuff on tape already as they get ready for Ole Miss. But have the offense come out and click with Garrett Nussmeier, bam, bam, boom, boom, four touchdowns. Garrett Nussmeier sits down, and then the other Tigers get to play. I'm looking at your story here. Last time in 2018, LSU won 31-0, but Joe Burrow only threw for 150 yards and two touchdown passes, and the Tigers were forced to punt six times. So although that was – you can't take anything for granted, I'm just saying.
Yeah. That's just kind of a interesting going back. We all remember the 2019 season and how spectacular Joe Burrow was, but there was a learning curve there in 2018 where for much of that season – LSU's offense really struggled. It really wasn't until November before that offense started playing much better. They went through a lot of their growing pains, much like this LSU offensive line. It's going through a lot of growing pains, and Brian Kelly continues to stand by his comments that, you know, he thinks this is going to be a really good offensive line when it's all said and done. And I do agree with him in that you do have an offensive line where a lot of guys are playing for the first time. It's a unit, all five guys who are playing together for the first time ever. And those things take time. But my concern is over the last 3 years or so, this is an offense that has really struggled to run football. And There's been a variety of reasons, and even when they've had.
Let me pick it up when we guys. Let me pick it up there. When we come back about running the football, because Jeff's got some great stories at WWL.com. One specifically about Juwan Johnson that I wanted to get back to when we return. 6:22 traffic, WWL. 6:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Tigers taking on Southeastern tomorrow in Tiger Stadium. Our coverage starts at 2 o'clock with Mike Dettelier, Herb Tyler, the Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show live from Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge. Jeff, you got a story up there at WWL.com, and I invite everybody to go to WWL.com and read the things you've written about Juwan Johnson. Talk about that. For people that don't know who Juwan Johnson is, give me a little backstory on him and where we are now.
Well, Juwan Johnson is one of the best high school football players the state of Louisiana has seen. This kid was a four-year starter at quarterback for Lafayette Christian. Took Lafayette Christian to the championship game multiple times. Terrific athlete, especially just electric with the football in his hands. Great high school quarterback, but that doesn't necessarily translate into being a great college quarterback. And when LSU recruited him out of Lafayette Christian, even though he set the record for most total yards and most total touchdowns by a high school football player in Louisiana, the LSU first put him out on defense. They thought he could maybe potentially be a cornerback. Last year when he had the injury to John Emery, they needed some help at running back. They needed some depth there. So they, during the season, really after the first week of the season, they moved Juwan Johnson to running back. And it's kind of a tough transition where you don't even have preseason camp to work on that. And he made a little bit of an impact, not much. And then, in the springtime, when Ricky Collins transferred to Syracuse, Colin Hurley had his car accident and the injuries that he had to recover from that kept him out of the spring. Juwan Johnson thought, hey, let me go back and play quarterback. That's my natural position. That's what I've played my whole life. I really think I could do it on the college level. And then he learned it's a whole different ballgame being a quarterback on the college football level, and then realized, hey, if I want to get on the field, I got to find another position on offense. So they put him at running back, and he's a guy that you would hope could have some sort of an impact, especially in the running game. We were just talking about it before the break, Tommy. This is a team that's still struggling to find a way to run the football, especially after the last 2 weeks. They really haven't ran the ball very well. And is Juwan Johnson possibly a solution, part of the solution to that problem?
I mean, when you say, Jeff, let me get this in real quick. When you say that it's different on a college level, are you talking about reading defenses? Because if he can still spin it, I would think having a running back there that gives you the passing option, man, that could be very valuable that LSU could use. Thoughts?
Well, I think before it's all said and done, if Juwan Johnson remains at running back at LSU, which I think he will, there's got to be a halfback pass option. Part of the playbook. That's got to be one of the trick plays that they have with Juwan Johnson.
But you just think how much that would open things up, right?
Yeah. But, you know, that's only a play, Tommy, you can really go to every now and then. What they want Juwan Johnson to do, what they really want to do is somehow try to get this, I think for him and Harlan Berry, because both guys are so elusive and they are so spectacular once you get them out in the open field, is try to get them in a chance where they are in the open field and they can use their speed and they can use their ability to make a defender miss in the open field and have big plays that way offensively. And
LSU
is trying to figure out a way to make that happen.
Let's hope they do. Thank you. So you think they win big?
Yeah, I got them winning 42-3. So we'll see if that happens.
All right. Thank you, Jeff Palermo. Pleasure as always, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. He's got some great stuff up at WWL.com. Quick break, then we come back. We'll talk to Louisiana Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. Right now, a minute late, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. It is 6:45, quarter till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Somebody texted in and said, y'all have people confused. Juwan Johnson is also the name of the Saints tight end. I would argue way more people know Saints Johnson than LSU Johnson. Well, what better way to distinguish the difference than by talking about LSU's Juwan Johnson, right? Also a big difference. The Saints tight end spells it J-U-W-A-N. Juwan Johnson with LSU spells it J-U-J-U-A-N Johnson. But I think we made it pretty clear that we were talking about LSU. So there you go. We're getting ready to talk to Billy Nungesser, Lieutenant Governor of the state of Louisiana, about his trip to Canada and trying to get some tourism going. I know the Canadians were mad at the United States for a while about tariffs, and I don't know if that's affected tourism to New Orleans or not, but we'll find out. How'd you like to win tickets to the next Saints game? Black and gold taking on a New York Giants in the Caesars Superdome on October 5th. You can score two premium tickets to the game, plus a pair of VIP tailgate passes from Bullseye Event Group. We're talking open bar with premium liquor, all-you-can-eat buffet from celebrity chef Aaron May, all overlooking Champion Square. Winning's easy. Go to WWL.com/contest and enter one time every day for your chance to win Saints-Giants tickets from Saints Radio, WWL. I don't know if you saw this or not, but, you know, President Trump says stuff, and I don't know if he says it to just kind of tweak people or not, or if he says it to try to send a veiled warning or not, but when he was talking about, Billy Nungesser is here. How you doing? Billy Nungesser, Lieutenant Governor, State of Louisiana.
Good morning, my friend. How you doing?
I'm okay, sir. Tell me about your trip to Canada and what it is you hope to do.
Well, we're in Toronto, Montreal, we're in Quebec today, meeting with the travel operators, the council general, elected officials, to try to bridge that gap of getting Canadians to come back to Louisiana. You know, the whole country has seen a great drop off in Canadian visitors, angry about the president wanting it to be the 51st state and the tariffs. And so it's our biggest international market. And so we want to come up here and let them know we still want them back in Louisiana and hopefully get them excited about coming back and visiting.
Do you address that at all, Billy, or do you just talk about the positives that Louisiana has to offer? And it's like, look, you're not going to. My approach would be this, and I don't know if you can do it as lieutenant governor or not, but my approach would be, first of all, you're not going to influence national policy on either side, either the Canadian or the American side. Secondly, you're only punishing yourself because Louisiana has a lot of great things to offer for your vacation, et cetera, et cetera. And it's somewhat of a quixotic mission, I guess. What would you tell them? How do you address that?
Yeah, well, you know, we talk about the long relationships we have with, I come up every 5 years for the Congress. We talk about all the Cajuns that have been for the Congre. It's a celebration of all the Cajuns, Canadians that were kicked out of Canada. Many ended up in South Louisiana. And every 5 years, we come here and celebrate with those families and bring hundreds of Louisianans here.
Never heard about that. The Congre, you teach me something every time I talk to you. And it happens every 5 years?
Yes. And we go to several villages up here, and then everybody marches down the street for a big celebration the last day. And so we do that. We spend a lot of time at the Jazz Fest. We do some cooking demonstrations. So we have many trips up here all year long. And so a lot of these people we know. We have a rep up here. But your question about, absolutely, several of the travel people that booked tours to America said, we love Louisiana, but we're not coming back till this president's gone, or we're greatly offended at the 51st state. I'm a little shocked at how strong they feel about that. Mm. Now, some of them are still traveling. They're not publicizing trips to America because the Canadian people are upset about that, and they don't want to get the negative impact of booking trips. So it's small groups and individuals that we hope to influence now, but a lot of the big tour operators are not. It's not been long enough. You know, yesterday on the radio, I said it'd be really nice if the president could apologize for that comment of the 51st state. That may help get the Canadians coming back to Louisiana.
On Canadian radio, Billy?
No, it's American radio.
I admire you for taking that stand. I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but no, I do, really, because, you know, anytime you go against the tide, Lord only knows what's going to happen. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back a little bit late getting to you, but we'll get back to you in a second. 6:50, 10 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56 now. Back to Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser. I'm Tommy Tucker. This is WWL. He's in Canada trying to get the Canadians to continue to visit Louisiana. Billy, did you say you were in Toronto or Quebec? Quebec.
We're in Quebec today. We were in Toronto first, then Montreal, and I got in Quebec yesterday.
53 degrees outside, going up to 63 today. I'll bet you're enjoying that.
It is. It's beautiful weather here. That's one great thing about this trip.
Tell me about when it comes to this Congre thing. Do you ever bring families up that reunite with their Cajun roots? That got my interest when you said that.
That's what happens, yes. They come from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I've been at several events where people have seen their relatives for the first time, either in many years, and some met new ones. And there's events all over the different provinces. And then at the end of the week, everybody gets together. They march down the street in a big parade, and then there's a big party. Every 5 years, I give a speech with the president of the country here and other elected officials about the great relationship we have with the Canadians. So it's a thing that Louisiana participates in every 5 years, and we get over 100 Louisianans that come up, and they are our best ambassadors because those personal relationships. And I think that's why, although it's way off, the travelers of Canadians to America, we're doing far better than other states because of those personal relationships. Mm-hmm. And because we really work this market hard.
And it's a good place to come. And when it comes to the French that the Canadians speak, and I know Cotefil's up there as well, but does Louisiana French translate to Canadian French or not?
It is. You know, the Cajun French is a little different, but they understand it, and you're right. Because we have so many French-speaking people in Louisiana, and especially in places like Quebec where they all speak French, it's a great way. They want to go there. They feel comfortable, and we reiterate that while we're up here. Several of the people with us give their presentation in French, and then we have Zachary Richard actually doing a video, and he's speaking in French and singing in French, and he's like a rock star up here in Canada. Mm. So we use those entertainers as well.
I'd like to know how the food compares with, you know, because you got the Cajun influence down here, but is that necessarily the same as Canadian food? Do they do anything up there that we do down here, or is it completely different?
Well, they like the spices. As a matter of fact, each day, each city we've been to, we've served Tabasco ice cream in the train station.
Really?
And I was there for a couple hours yesterday, and it gets a great response. Handing people that spicy ice cream, and we give out some little Tabasco bottles, and the food is a big thing. These are food cities up here. They love their food, and of course, we highlight this was the year of food for Louisiana. Next year will be the year of outdoors, so we'll highlight all the great things to do outdoors in Louisiana. So we kind of play off all those assets we have.
Man, I'm going to tell you what, I don't know when your term ends or if you can run again or not, but they ought to make you the pro tem ambassador for Louisiana for the rest of your life. That's what they should do, Billy. Thank you, man. I appreciate your time. Travel safely, all right?
Thank you, my friend. Have a great day.
Hey, look, if you get a chance, try those Laura Secord cookies. Somebody brought me one of those one time. Man, that's the best cookie I've had in my life.
I'm going to get one today. Thank you.
Try it. Laura Secord is the name of it. Thank you. Billy Nungesser, our friend. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Ian Ozan, co-host of the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. Prep football heating up. We'll get the latest on that. Then we're going to talk to Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board. A lot coming up. Stay with us. WWL. 7:14 now. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Ian Ozan, whom you just heard with the news, also co-host of the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. And if you don't listen to it, you should, because they put Friday night around the state on the air here on WWL, and you don't even have to go to the games. How you doing, Ian?
I'm doing well this morning, Tommy. How are you, sir?
I am okay. Tell me what y'all looking at tonight.
So tonight we're going to be live at your alma mater, Archbishop Shaw, as the megaphone rivalry continues. The Eagles taking on the Rummel Raiders. And Tommy, as an alumnus, you know this dates back to the 1960s when these two schools opened. Rummel won last year 35-21, but Shaw used that loss to propel themselves to their first state title since 1987. Last week, Rummel Rummel looked awfully good. They beat U-High in convincing fashion, 30-17 in the Superdome. Jayton Terrence, Corian Hawkins, both of them juniors. They combined for more than 200 yards in that game, plus three touchdowns, including a kickoff return by Terrence. So this is going to be a tough task for a Shaw team that really and truly is still has a lot of question marks surrounding it. They're young. They lost a lot of talent from last year's state championship team. And even though they beat West Jeff last week 49-0, I'm not sure that we were able to glean much from that win. The week before, they lost Etna Carr 35-0. So it's been a tale of two games so far, looking to see if they can figure out a way to beat Rummel this week.
Man, I get confused when we talk about select and non-select and who's in what division. So when it comes to Shaw and Rummel, compare and contrast.
So both of these schools are in select divisions. Archbishop Rummel is Division I, which used to be Class 5A. So if you want to break it down, Division I is equal to Class 5A. Meanwhile, Shaw is a 4A school. They're playing in Division II. They're both private parochial schools. That puts them in the select. If you're a private school, a parochial school, or if you're a public school that's open enrollment, or school of choice or a charter school, you're in select. If you're a traditional public school where you have attendance zones, then you're non-select.
So when it comes to the category of the division, that's because of the enrollment?
Correct. That's once the playoffs begin, we go from the classification system to the divisions. All of Class 5A and the most populous schools in 4A play in Division 1, then the rest of 4A and the biggest 3A schools play in Division 2 and on down to Division 5.
What are some other big matchups y'all are looking at tonight?
Maybe the biggest matchup on the docket tonight that we're looking at is Alexandria at Destrehan. If you're going to go to a game that's not Shaw or Rummel, this may be it, because Alexandria's offense is absolutely explosive. Get this, in 2 weeks of the season so far, they've outscored their opponents 111-7. And those opponents are no slouches. The West Feliciana team that made a run deep into the playoffs last year and a Union Parish squad that got to the state finals last year. Now, granted, Union Parish is down this year, but I don't think anybody expected Alexandria to steamroll them the way they did last week and shut them out. Now, with that said, the only team that can beat Destrehan is Destrehan. Their only loss of the season was in week one to Catholic of Baton Rouge. That was the result of turnovers, penalties, mistakes, things we typically don't see from Destrehan, a disciplined squad. Last week, they seemed to get that under control against Bonneville. They beat them 58-20, but the Destrehan defense will have a tough time against it, against a team that got to the state finals last year, brought back most of that talent, and is looking to get back to the Superdome this year with their explosive offense.
So tell me some of the other games you're looking at besides those.
St. Charles Catholic at Dunham. St. Charles Catholic goes on the road to Baton Rouge tonight to play a Dunham squad that has the number one national recruit in the class of 2027. That's their junior quarterback, Elijah Haven. He's 6'5", 215. He may be a high school junior, but this kid is a man. He's being recruited by Alabama, by Florida, by Georgia, LSU, Auburn, and the list goes on and on.
What's his name
on.
Again?
Elijah Haven. And this kid,
man,
as a
who's he play for?
For Dunham, out of Baton Rouge. This kid, a couple years ago as a freshman, was turning heads, and we thought, okay, he might be special. Last year, he proved he was beyond special, and St. Charles is going to have a tough time stopping him tonight. Though, we've got to give St. Charles credit. Last year, in their first year playing up in classification in 4A, this was a squad that had a tough time. They finished the regular season 4-6. They won a playoff game, but they knew that it would be a bit of a challenge. So far this year, St. Charles has done a good job with their opponents. They beat Newman 36-3. They shut out Letcher last week 28-0, but they've not seen anything like Elijah Haven. 535 total yards last week, 8 total touchdowns. His mate in the running back, Jarvis Washington, a senior who's committed to South Alabama, accounted for nearly half the output. He caught 11 passes, 259 yards, and 4 of those touchdowns. So St. Charles will have their hands full tonight. But with that said, week 3 with rivalries and with teams starting to feel themselves, a win is not out of the question for the Comets.
So, wait a minute, I'm trying to get back to this kid. It's 6'5", 215. He's a running back?
He is a quarterback.
A quarterback, yes. Okay, that makes sense. And what class is he in? Is he a sophomore, junior?
He is a junior. So he is the number one recruit in his class nationally. In fact, he had a look from Cornell, but he's already ruled that out. He's looking at an SEC school in LSU, Georgia, Auburn, Florida, Alabama, they're all in the mix to get this kid in the sweepstakes come next year.
Jesuit at Bonneville.
Jesuit at Bonneville. That game is going to be at Joe Yenny Stadium. Scott Phillips will be there tonight. Jesuit is coming into this game. They're looking good. Bonneville last week didn't hold up well against Destrehan. They're 1-1. This is one of these games where Jesuit goes in and it's a possible trap for them. Bonneville maybe 500, but this is a winnable game for Jesuit. This one quite possibly could get out of hand quick.
Okay. How about De La Salle at, what is it, St.
De La Salle at St. Paul's. That one's going to be on the North Shore. And this is one where De La Salle goes in playing a St. Paul's team that is always primed for a playoff run. And St. Paul's, they lost in the playoffs earlier than expected last year. I think they got to the second round, if I remember correctly, and then were eliminated at that point. But St. Paul's is strong again this year. They have a good bit of talent from last year's squad. De La Salle, though, trying to find their footing. This is a team that got to the quarterfinals a few years back, and they've sputtered to start the season, trying to get a big win, and a big win this would be if they were able to beat St. Paul's.
Tell me what you put on the air tonight, Ian, for people that don't know, that haven't listened.
So for those who aren't familiar, we typically are live at a school every week. We pick a school, we go there, and we broadcast from that stadium. And then we have anywhere between 10 and 15 correspondents who are on the road sending reports back to us. Tonight we have 10 reporters at Booker T. Washington Covington, St. Charles at Dunham, Pineville Tioga, South Platte at Belle Chasse, Slidell Warren Easton, Lakeshore at North Shore, De La Salle St. Paul's, Jesuit Bonneville, Pine at Franklinton, and Alexandria Destrehan. We also have someone at McDonough 35 and Edna Carr, their public address announcer, so when he gets a break, he'll phone in reports. But we have reporters at a bunch of games around the area and across the state. They phone in reports. Coach Lou and I provide score updates throughout the night, an interview or two with whoever drops by. And as you said earlier, we put Louisiana high school football on the map and on the radio. Last year, got a text message from Knoxville, Tennessee, someone saying, hey, we hear you loud and clear on the Big 870. So there's a huge audience. And for the Elijah Havens of the world or some of the other big name players, you have coaches or parents or football fans in general who are listening who may not know about these kids, but once they hear about them, they follow them all throughout their high school, their college career, and for those who go pro, throughout their professional careers.
How do you go about getting this network of reporters together? It can't be easy.
It's not, but these are guys who do what they love, and for the vast majority of them, they've been with this for 5, 10, some guys have been doing this for 20 years, and they enjoy it. They get in touch with us, and in some cases, their friends like, hey, how'd you get involved with that? Then they get in touch with us, and we add them into the rotation.
It's a Friday night tradition, I'll tell you that. Thank you, Ian. I know you got to go. You're ready for news. We appreciate it. Ian Ozan, and it is the Prep Football, Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. Ian Ozan, Coach Lou Valden, tonight and every Friday night at 7. It is the most comprehensive high school football show in America. They're going to be live tonight from Shaw at the, the Eagles are hosting Archbishop Rummel. And Shaw's got a stadium on a campus now, and they got a nice game day experience where, boy, I'm going to tell you what, it's a good family-friendly atmosphere. The kids can go and socialize, and it's safe, and they've done a great job out there. They really have. Other matchups, McDonough 35 at Edna Carr, Alexandria at Destrehan, St. Charles Catholic at Dunham, where they got that 6'5", 215 quarterback, Jesuit at Bonneville, De La Salle at St. Paul's, and a whole lot more. Get ready. Friday Night Lights, the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup, presented by Acadian Companies and Dr. Pepper, this evening from 7 till 10:30. It is only on WWL. Time now for traffic. All right, 7:28 now on this Friday morning, making our way nicely through it as we matriculate toward the weekend. We've already spoken to Jeff Palermo, Billy Nungesser, Ian Ozan about the Friday night prep football round. Manning Family, you know what it is, the Manning Family Children's Prep Football Roundup. There we go. If you missed any of it, all you have to do is download the Odyssey app. You can listen to this show and WWL Time Shifted Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Still to come, we'll talk to Steve Nelson on the other side of the news. He's the General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board. We'll get an update on that delayed substation that they've been working on. We'll talk about where the city and the Sewerage and Water Board stands with that. 8 o'clock, we're going to talk to Mike Dettillier, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk, take a look at the Saints-Seahawks game. Then we'll talk to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. New Orleans facing a huge budget deficit. The city's been instituting some cost-saving measures, but How did we get here, and what does that mean for the next mayor? 9 o'clock, in case you've not heard, Arthur Hardy, the publisher, the guy that does the Mardi Gras guide, is retiring after Mardi Gras this year. So we're going to go up close and personal and with him, find out how he got started, hear his story, and find out what's next for him. Then we'll wrap it up by getting you some winners with JR with Taking Vegas, and not next Friday, but the Friday after that, we'll start managing my money with JR, and we're going to I'm going to put up $5,000 of my own money and see how he does. 7:30, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to the aforementioned Ian Ozen. We are in a drought. Latest drought monitor has been released, and compared to late, we're seeing more of the area in drought conditions, at least, which is good for the Surge and Water Board because they don't have any water to pump. However, it is going to rain again, and when it does, they will have to pump that water. With that, we welcome in Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Surge and Water Board of New Orleans. How you doing, Steve?
Hey, living the dream, doing well, Tommy. Thank you. How are you?
A professional engineer. I guess you got to like it when it's sunny, huh? Everything works fine with the Surge and Water Board?
It removes the risk of flooding is awfully mm-hmm. reduced when it doesn't rain. It does create some strain on some of our water pipes because we see soil consolidation. But, yeah, as far as stormwater goes, pretty easy when there's nothing falling.
You know what? That's interesting. Talk about that, because with no rain, the water table, help me if I hurt myself here, the water table shrinks, and as a result, pipes can subside and break like water mains or what?
Yeah, so you kind of hit the nail on the head there. Some of our soils here in Orleans Parish are similar to the sponge on the side of your kitchen sink. And when that sponge dries out, it consolidates, and the pipes that are in the soil, they don't like to move. They're meant to stay static. So we've seen this a couple of times in my short tenure here. You'll see more water main breaks in the summer. And then when it starts to rain again, you can see more issues with sewer later on in the year.
So is there any way to monitor the water table, Steve? You're an engineer. Tell me.
Yeah, there are actually water table monitoring wells across Orleans Parish that we're working with the city on, actually working on putting some monitoring, real-time monitoring digitally there. But there are monitoring wells across the city.
But bottom line, there's nothing you can do. You can't artificially increase the water table, can you?
There's not really a good way to do that. I mean, if you have leaks in your sewer pipes or leaks in your water pipes, that goes into the groundwater table. But there's nothing like an inch or two of rain to increase that.
Well, there you go. One question leads to another, which is, I know we have a lot of fresh water leaking right every day still because of leaky pipes and so forth. Does that do anything to offset a drought when it comes to the water table?
I wouldn't say that there's enough. We do have leaky pipes, but I wouldn't say there's enough to offset the groundwater table rise. I think rain is the best way to keep your groundwater high.
Yeah, it's the same thing with watering the lawn. You can try with a hose, but ain't nothing like a good rain. Tell me what's going on with this power plant, the Carrollton Water Plant, the power plant that is. How are we referring to this thing, the Carrollton Water Plant?
The power complex.
Power
located
complex.
At the Carrollton Water Plant. So, yeah, where you see the two big water towers, that's also where we generate that 25 hertz electricity that we've been talking about for 120 years. And actually, as of Monday, we're going to enter what we're referring to as a reliability testing phase, which really just means we're going to run it under operating conditions. It looks like it's supposed to rain next week. We're going to run it just like we would turbine 4, turbine 5. We're just going to have the manufacturer staff on site with our staff as we run it. So we're talking about weather patterns. The ideal for us would be to get a quarter to a half to an inch of rain on a daily basis, 2, 3, 4, 5 days a week, so we can put it through its paces. We want to see it run at this point. It's done well. We've run it on drainage pumps. We've run it on potable water pumps. We had a test on Monday. Running at 24 hours at over 20 megawatts. We need 44 megawatts at peak demand. So it's performing well.
Can you test it if it doesn't rain?
You can run it. We can run some of our potable water pumps, but it's pretty tough to really put what we call a dynamic load. We have something called a load bank, which is basically a giant space heater that can provide a big demand, but it's very linear, and the pumps have fluctuating power demand. So we do want to see some rain so we can get some water in our canals and see how it runs the pumps under a dynamic or less stable load. So the weather pattern next week looks really good for testing that.
When it comes to pipes that leak, somebody texted in, is the concern more about drainage or supply pipes that leak? Is there one that leaks more than the other?
Well, what I was talking about was more the water supply pipes.
Right.
We see more breakage. Well, you see the breakage when it's dry because the water will surface. But we are also getting failures, breaks on sewer lines. They don't like, or storm drains as well. They don't like it when the soil moves either. You just don't see that until it starts to rain again.
So have you had a big increase in the amount of leaks that are popping up that you now know where they were when you didn't know because it wasn't so dry?
It's moderate this year. That summer of 2023, it was multiple weeks. It was a record in terms of a serious record in terms of heat, and also a record in terms of drought. And we did see a dramatic increase in the number of water main leaks and service leaks that year in particular. This year, a little bit of an uptick, but 2023 was significant.
Let me pick it up here. We come back. Steve Nelson, our guest, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board, talking about the power complex at the Carrollton Water Plant. You got any questions or comments? Text them in, 504-260-1870. That's the Oquinar Jeweler Talk and Text line. More when we return. Traffic now, WWL. 757, 3 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Back with Steve Nelson, General Superintendent of the Sewerage and Water Board of New Orleans. We're talking about the power complex at the Carrollton Water Plant. Somebody texted in, Steve, about, so it's still going to be an inch an hour, half inch after that. Again, that's a generalization for the entire system. But without this power, while this doesn't increase that capacity, without this power, you couldn't guarantee that's going to happen.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns.
You know why
fans.
It's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, without this power plant in terms of continuity of power?
Yes, that is correct, and a great point made. It does not increase the capacity that we've got. That is, that inch an hour, the first hour, half hour thereafter, or every hour thereafter. But you're absolutely correct. Wherein you're dealing with that 25 hertz power that's being generated from assets like Turbine 4, which was made in the World War I horse and buggy era, you're going to have a lot more risk profile there, and that's what we've seen. The pumps generally run. You can see that real time on our website. The pumps are running, but the issues have historically been for us the power supply and having reliable 25 hertz power. So it's going to make it much, much simpler. So instead of having a dozen different sources of power, we're going to have this power complex with three frequency changers, double redundancy, keep Turbine 5 and Turbine 6 and Turbine 7 available for backup. So we're going to be in a much more stable, much more reliable place.
Steve, 30 seconds real quick. How's the installation of smart meters going, and how about catch basin cleaning?
Oh, the smart meters are great. We've got over 130,000 in the ground right now. Folks can sign up on their portal at swbno.org to see real-time, hour-by-hour usage. I run into somebody just about every day that says they have gotten an alert about a continuous usage, a leak, found an issue with a toilet, a pool, what have you. And then the last item that you were talking about, catch basin cleaning, we got about 10% of the catch basins done. We've pulled over 5.5 million pounds of debris out of the system thus far this year. So that after the power complex, I'm fully convinced, is the most important thing we can do to positively affect folks' day-to-day lives.
You got that right, bro. Thank you, Steve Nelson. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. We can go back. We'll talk to Mike Dettelier about the Saints Seahawks. Then we'll talk to Joe Geruso about the city and its budget problems. Tommy Tucker, WWL. The Saints battling the Seahawks in Seattle on Sunday. You can start your game day at 11 o'clock with Steve Geller, Charlie Long, and the Caesars Sportsbook First Take. Then at 1 o'clock, join Bobby Hebert, Steve Geller for the Bud Light Countdown to Kickoff. They'll break down the matchup, 3:05 kickoff. Turn down the sound on the TV, turn up Deuce and Haas and Jeff Nowak on the sideline. Then, after the game, sound off with the Cajun Cannon on the point after. If you love football, we got 10 hours of it. Wall-to-wall black and gold coming your way, Saints Seahawks Sunday on WWL, live on the free Odyssey app. And sometimes if you listen to Deuce, I call him Deustradamus because he can predict what's going to happen before it does. Mike Dettelier joins us now to break down the game. How you doing, Mike?
I'm fine. Tell me. Thank you.
Well, I got the depth charts open. Let's talk about Seattle offense and Saints defense.
Seattle wants to run the football. And you can see just out of the makeup and Clint Kubiak, who was formerly with the Saints last year as their offensive coordinator, runs the offense. And so you know they're going to run it, and you're going to get a fistful of Kenneth Walker. Charbonnet's sort of beat up a little bit right now. I think he's dealing with a foot or ankle injury. But so you're going to get a lot of Kenneth Walker. That's how they set the tone of trying to run the football with Walker. And I look at their receivers, and they sort of both do the same thing. You talk about the veteran and Cooper Kupp. Of so many years we watched him with the Rams. The most explosive guy certainly is Jackson Smith, Najigma, former Ohio State receiver. Man, he's one of the best route runners in the game. He's not this super speedy guy, but his ability to get open downfield is really good. So him and Cooper Kupp, I think, have a good combination. The problem has been what I see is their offensive line has been a little erratic. And with the new quarterback in Sam Darnold, who's not the most mobile guy around, he likes to kind of stay in put and throw from the pocket. So can the Saints get any pressure on him? That's going to be the key. But when you play Seattle and knowing what they want to run with Kubiak, they're going to want to run the football. That's first and foremost. You got to stop the run.
Ironic, he's not the most mobile, but he's done a lot of traveling, huh, Sam Darnold?
And he got paid. Man,
yeah,
did he get a paycheck?
Yep.
Man, he went to Minnesota, and Kevin O'Connell really did a great job with him, really kind of roughing out some of the difficult spots in this game. But, man, he's a huge guy, and he probably gave me one of the best quotes I've ever had when it comes to the Manning Passing Academy. He's at USC. And I asked him, you know, how it is here. And he was like, well, it's the first time I've ever been in South Louisiana. Man, it is so hot here. But he said, the people are the nicest people in the world. He said, I grew up in a big city out in Los Angeles. They mean there. People here are really nice. And so, man, they could have used that for a Chamber of Commerce deal with Sam Darnold. But
so
he's been a bit erratic as a passer. And you understand that early on with Seattle, but, man, he has shown at times he can be really talented.
So let's talk about the Seahawks offensive line against Saints defensive line. How do you see that playing out if they want to run the ball?
That's not a strong point for them. It really hasn't. I think the Saints maybe can match up really well there. But, you know, I felt last week, you know, with the 49ers offensive line, which isn't very good. It's comparable to Seattle. The Saints got a little pressure, you know, on Mac Jones, but not a lot. Their offensive line was something they kind of gnashed their teeth about in the offseason, that they want to try to fix some of that. And they used their first-round pick for an offensive lineman, and Gray Zabel. So they tried to fix one of the areas, but they not a super physical offensive line. They really not. They more to me of a finesse blocking team than they are a real physical unit up front.
So along those lines, you look at, I don't know, is Chase Young supposed to play or not?
No, Chase will not play.
All right, so you got Granderson, who's not played badly, Devon Gotcha, you got Brian Brisset, and then Cam Jordan. How do you like the Saints' chances of stopping the run, plus the linebackers, of course, you can't ignore them, but the chances of Saints stopping the run, if that's what Clint Kubiak and Seahawks intend to do?
That is going to be the key here for the Saints defensively, stopping the run. My thing is, hey, if Sam Darnold beats me throwing it, but I'm not going to let you run the football and Kenneth Walker have 28 carries for 150 yards. I can't not have that happen in this football game. I've got to be able to stop them early, and I think that's going to be the game plan. Because we saw even in game one against the 49ers, and man, that was a really tough game for Seattle. 49ers won that game at the end, but Seattle did everything to win it but win it. Mm-hmm. You know, the score says San Francisco won, so that's all that counted.
But it was the Bosa strip, right?
Well, it was not a great game for them offensively, and they didn't do, I think, what a Kubiak team wants to do, and that's control things up front along the offensive line. So for the Saints, they got to be able to stop the run, and that starts with one guy, Kenneth Walker.
Comes the wideouts with the Cooper Kupp and Njigba, and lining up against Alante Taylor, Kool-Aid McKinstry. How you see that playing out?
Short stuff. I think Darnold's going to want to get the football out fast.
And along those lines, that brings me to A.J. Barner, the tight end. Sometimes, man, we don't hear about these tight ends until they show up big on game day against the Saints.
Well, that they do each and every week. But they've got a young rookie, Elijah Arora, from Miami of Florida. It was a second-round pick for them this year who they think is going to be something special one day. Mm-hmm. And so that you may see something there. He's number 18, and you can spot him out on the field real quickly. But Elijah's a guy that I think they want to get more involved in the offense. Now, he's not a great blocker, but he's stretching the imagination, which is why he's not starting. He's much more of a pass receiver, but he's a 6'5.5", 245-pound guy downfield that's going to give teams a lot of trouble. Once he gets it in the NFL, he's going to be a good pain in the yuck-to-be to anybody that got to cover him.
You don't want that to happen ever. We'll take a break. We come back. We'll talk about Seattle defense against Saints offense. Mike Dettillier breaking it down for us. Saints getting ready to take on Seattle on Sunday. In Seattle, we got all the action for you here on WWL. Traffic now at 8:20. 8:27 Friday morning, WWL, Tommy Tucker with Mike Dettillier. That's when we break it down and look at the depth charts and go player to player. We're now talking about the Seattle defense against the Saints offense. Mike, what's the, as you say, straw that stirs the drink on a Seattle defense?
What they got up front, their defensive line. Leonard Williams, number 99, who's played both defensive tackle and then former USC guy, who was one of the early round picks a few years back. Man, he's a big man, very good athlete, and he can run the field extremely well. So you better put a hat on him. But the guy that really has played extremely well this year is their nose tackle, number 91, Byron Murphy II, University of Texas, first-round pick in 2024. He's barely 6 foot tall and about 315 pounds. But, man, he is as quick as you will see coming off the snap.
Kelvin Banks would have gone against him.
Oh, I'm sure in practice they have, you know, at times. But Byron's been more of an interior. I mean, he's an inside guy. So Banks won't be blocking him. He'll be saddled up over one of the guards most likely. And then they got a couple veterans after that. DeMarcus Lawrence, who we all remember from his days with the Cowboys. And Jerron Reed, who's sort of bounced around a little bit. But, boy, he's found a good niche, former University of Alabama. Defensive tackle with Seattle. That is their strength. That's the strength of this football team. Can you block those guys up front? Because, man, they come after you. They get a lot of penetration. They're fast off the snap. And Mike McDonald, their head coach, he comes from Baltimore with the Ravens. That's what this defense in a lot of ways looks like. When they're healthy all across the board, they look a lot like the Ravens defense.
So where do the Saints offensively find the weakness and exploit it?
Oh, it's in the secondary because of the injuries. Their best player on the team is Devin Witherspoon. But Spoon has been nursing a knee injury for a couple weeks. I don't think he'll play against the Saints, so you won't have to go up against them, against him. But Josh Jobe, their starting left corner, is hurt. Julian Love, their starting strong safety, is hurt. Nick Emmanuori, their second-round pick from South Carolina, who's the backup to Love, he's hurt. So if you got time, I think you can go after this secondary. The problem is finding time, because you got to block those guys up front. Now the Saints won't have Dylan Raidens. Taliese Fuaga is got a back and a knee injury. So you're going to have some jumbling up front across the offensive line going up against, Tommy, I think, a really good Seattle defensive line. That's the issue. Because if you were, if you healthy up front, yeah, you can go after them. People say, just throw it. You can't throw it if you're horizontal. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to keep Spencer Rattler upright in this game, because Seattle's going to go after him. And just think, Kubiak knows a lot about Spencer. He was here a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little intel there that he can pass along to the Seahawks defensive coaches.
General rule of thumb, when you're looking at a Saints offensive lineman and then you're looking at your phone saying, who's number 79?
Yeah.
Where did he come from? Not a good sign. Do you think they win, Mike?
I think Seattle wins. No, it's tough to win in Seattle.
Yeah.
Not because of the weather. In years past, remember we talk about the weather? Now, you're not going to have that type of weather in September. But, boy, it is loud.
The crowd,
And it really disrupts. Drew Brees, when we had him on, talked about it was all sort of hand signals and sort of just watch me, watch for the count. He said you cannot communicate verbally in that stadium. It's so loud.
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. We'll talk to you Monday. You bet, 8:30 time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozan. Joe Geruso, got me on mute.
I'm here. Can you hear me, Tommy?
I can hear you fine, sir. How many days left in office?
116.
Yeah, I know you're counting it down. Let's talk about the whole budgeting process, and we'll go through this in a lightning round, if you will, where the dollar values have tripled, probably not when talking about budget. Let's talk about the whole budgeting process. The mayor submits a budget, the council approves it, and then that's based on an estimate of how much money the city's going to have, accurate?
That is completely right.
All right, so what happened here?
Well, there's a couple.
Take a step back, Joe. We're talking about fiscal year here and not calendar year?
Well, calendar year for the city is the same thing as fiscal year.
Okay.
We run from the beginning. It's a great question, because that's not always the case, but it is January 1 through December 31st.
Gotcha.
So there's a few things that happens here that I think just kind of bear the history, which is where we made the settlement with the school board in November, which we believe the administration agreed to. And then as payment is getting ready to come up for the school board settlement, there were factions inside the administration that said, well, hold on. Remember, this is the word that they use. There's a financial crisis, and we need to be very careful.
Mm-hmm.
And as we dug in, there was an issue of there being less revenue by an order of magnitude over $65 million.
To be clear, we're talking about 2025 here, right?
This is 2024 going into 2025. Correct.
But about the 2025 budget.
Correct. Exactly.
Okay. Gotcha.
And then we also said, by the way, what we're seeing right now as a result of the February 2025 report for January is there's a $40 million NOPD and other departments personnel overage. We are concerned about that. And I think, Tommy, like, the most interesting thing at that point was you had two different competing things inside the administration. You had one group saying, hey, this is a huge problem and we need to be very careful. And you had another group saying, no, like, this is an issue, but we're going to work our way through the issue. And this is the beginning of the year, and these things have their necessary ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And Councilmember Morrell would kick me if I didn't make this point, so I will. He specifically asked, do we have to consider ourselves at DEFCON 1, where this is now such a big financial crisis, we cannot spend any money? And the administration said no to that.
So this is the administration's responsibility to determine how much revenue is coming in, accurate?
It is accurate that it's their responsibility to determine how much revenue is coming in. And here's the second point, which I know is a little esoteric, but it's the case. The council is responsible for appropriating the money, and then the administration is responsible for executing upon that appropriation. So, I mean, again, to sort of clear some air here about what's going on, if we appropriate, I'll make simple little numbers, a dollar for something, and the administration spends $1.50 on the thing that we've appropriated for, well, then they've overspent on the appropriation. Mm-hmm. And
wait, go through that one more time, Joe. I think that's very interesting the way you said that.
Yeah, so let's say we appropriate a dollar for something. We appropriate to a department a dollar. You can spend a dollar for your personnel costs. But if the administration spends $1.50 for the personnel costs, well, they've exceeded the appropriation, number one. And then number two, we, the council, don't learn until the back end. And this is sort of the necessary tension that goes on is, remember, the budget is something that you want to agree to with the mayor and the administration because they need to be able to go do the things. You don't want to hamstring them and blame them for not having money for police and fire.
Let me jump in. I don't want to get too far in the weeds, but as I always say, if you play golf for money, that's where most of the cheating comes in and where the money changes hands. So when it comes to a dollar for this, the mayor says we need a dollar for this, and the city council says, okay, you can have a dollar for that. The budget's approved. Then the mayor spends $1.50, or the administration spends $1.50. What does the law say about that? Who's keeping an eye on that? And at what point does it fall upon whom to fix that or deal with that deficit? Because already you've overspent your budget by 50 cents.
I would say it's a primary responsibility of the administration because you're supposed to know that you're only supposed to spend a dollar. Mm-hmm. But here comes the next part, in fairness. But when the council is aware, then the council has to say, whoa, we're off the tracks now. What do we need to do to get back on? And look, Tommy, I realize I'm a player in this and have my own view, but when we saw all this, we specifically said we are not going to spend more general fund revenue, which is the money that's free and clear that we get from property taxes, sales taxes, licenses, fees, until we feel like we're out of the woods. So we pretty much have not approved any new position in the city of New Orleans since the beginning of the year and have tried to limit that general fund spending that was going on. Now, I think here's the next step of all this. All right, so we start to have this discussion in January or February. In May, because we're pushing for it, and to your question of kind of making sure we're in close quarters, the administration says, here's our plan for trying to save money, what we need to do. And our expectation was that would be activated and then there would be things that would happen. And I think what we saw this week is there are certain parts of that plan that have been activated and are going to happen. And there's other parts that don't feel like they've happened yet. And so we're trying to make sure that we're all on the same page. And for those things that were $1.50, how do we control spending or sometimes even move money from one pot to another one?
Let me jump in for 1 second, Joe. So basically you're rebudgeting at this point because the mayor can't spend money that the council doesn't allocate. The money the council has to allocate the money if the mayor overspends, and that's where you're back to almost like a de facto budget hearing?
Yeah, that's what we're back to. And
okay,
so
let me take a break and pick it up right there when we come back. 852, 8 till 9, traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:57, couple of minutes left. So the when in a budgeting process, the mayor says this, the administration says this is what we want. The council says yes or no. The amount of money that is available is dependent upon the administration's estimates, Joe?
Yeah, it's their revenue forecast that you get, and then beginning at the year, then you start to see where the revenue comes in.
Now let me jump in for a second. Does the city have cash on hand?
Yes, but that was also an issue at the beginning of the year because of the fact that we were using money to pay off FEMA projects that was limiting cash, and now that cash flow is better.
So what does the law say about the city and cash on hand or general reserve, however you phrase that?
Yeah, I don't know if there's a law per se. There's two things. One, we have to keep a minimum amount in a rainy day fund for a true emergency, for example, if a hurricane hits. And I think it's going to be this year about $37 million in that fund. Mm-hmm. And then what they say is sort of best general practices is to have about 2 months of general fund money on hand, which would be about $150 million.
All right, so let me ask you this. Real quick, before we run out of time, we got 90 seconds left. Where's the $65 million going to come from? And does that mean cuts to services, or what's the rest of 2025 look like? And what about 2026?
Yeah, well, you're asking the right question. I think the issue right now is we don't have a common set of facts, which is creating a lot of the confusion. And I spoke with Councilmember Moreno about this recently, and we're going to ask the legislative auditor to come in to look at everything, just as we've done with vendor payments and the sheriff. So that way, to your point, we know what's going on this year, and we're on a good path for the future.
Even with the $65 million deficit?
The $65 million may actually be what goes into the fund balance. I'm happy to come back next week and explain all of that.
Do that, please.
I don't know, I can do it in 10 seconds.
No, you can't. Do that, please. Come back, because it's important stuff. It really is. And that's why I wanted to go into, I didn't spend too much time talking about the process, because it doesn't just happen, and people need to understand. Like, for example, the best practice is 2 months. That's what they say for us, all of us, with our personal finances. Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. We come back. Arthur Hardy is retiring, in case you've not heard. When we come back, we're going to talk to Arthur Hardy and get his story. From when he was a little bitty boy all the way until now on WWL. All right, here we go, 9:09, and I guess there comes a time for everybody. We found out that Arthur Hardy, the creator of the Mardi Gras Guide, is going to retire, and Ian McNulty referred to him as New Orleans' number one Mardi Gras authority. Ian is normally with us at this time, but couldn't be, but it's worked out because we wanted to talk to Arthur Hardy anyway. He's our friend. How you doing, Arthur?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you, buddy?
I'm okay. I'm glad to hear about your retirement and sorry to hear about it all at the same time.
It's a little bit.
I know you have family out of the country, and I guess you decided to just spend some more time enjoying life.
Yes, indeed. It's, you know, there's a time, and I think this is it. But I'm not going yet. Ain't there no more yet.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a magazine to put out, and I'll be doing this, you know, by Ash Wednesday officially. I'll be out the door. You know, they say it's better to walk out the door than be thrown out the door, carried out the door.
Right.
So I'll be 80 years old next year, I think.
No. Really?
Yep. Been a great ride, though, man.
Yourself like that. You carry yourself like you're a lot younger than that. Well, let me ask you this. I know you're affiliated with carnival organizations. Even though you're retiring from the guide, you're not retiring from Mardi Gras itself, are you?
Oh, no. I plan to ride and plan to be able to see more parades now. Actually, I love parades. And because I'm locked in media-wise, with one television station, I can't see three parades in a night. I'm stuck at one, and so you'll see me on the street. I can promise you.
So, will you still be doing TV work or not?
No. I'm making a clean break from everything. I think that's the easiest way to do it. I'm looking forward to it. When I travel, when I spend time with the family, as you mentioned, I have my daughter works at the Nobel Institute in Oslo, Norway, and his twins, and it's a long trip. I'm going to be able to get over there more often, and two grandsons here in New Orleans, so I'll be busy.
So Let me ask you this. Is there an heir apparent? Do you hand the torch to somebody or not?
Well, the Times-Picayune bought George's media, bought mm-hmm. the magazine 3 years ago and allowed me to stay on through this anniversary issue to run it. They've got a whole staff of people led by Victor Andrews, who's a big Mardi Gras connoisseur and knows a whole lot, knows all the players and where the bodies are buried. So it's gonna be fine. The magazine will continue, and probably my name will still be on it. I'll be around. But I just think it's appropriate to make a clean break and do some other things with the last 25 years of my life. I'm planning to make it to at least 100, so I've got some more time to go.
Tell me about some of the coverages that you've done, people you've worked with, because I'm looking at an article here that you sent me. I see you with Garland and Angela when they were at Channel 4. You and then with David Tyree here at WWO. Yeah. You've been doing this a while.
I have, and that article is actually going to be in our 50th anniversary edition, kind of a look back on how the magazine developed. When we started, we didn't have any money to advertise, so being King Cheap, as my daughter calls me, we tried to figure out how to get free publicity, and that was by trading magazines for ads. For radio station, we're going to do a giveaway, give them $300 worth of magazines, and then mm-hmm. give us $300 worth of quote-unquote free ads. And that's how it all started, really. No matter how good your product is, if people don't know about it, so, well. But we've really been blessed, and I worked for all three major TV stations in town, and all have been wonderful. And I was pleasantly, more than surprised, shocked that Channel 4 did a little feature on me last night, mm-hmm. looking back through the years. That normally doesn't happen when you work for Station B. Station A doesn't put you on the air unless you're dead. mm-hmm. And so I was really flattered by that. And anyhow, it's just been great, man. I think I'm one of the luckiest people alive, really.
So when you were a kid, I don't think you envisioned yourself being the publisher of the Mardi Gras guy, did you?
No. I wanted to be a band director. I became one. I used to go to parades and march in parades as a kid. But, no, the Mardi Gras business was nowhere near my mind until the late 70s, really, when we did the first Mardi Gras guy. And we worked on it in 1976, but it came out in 77.
So when it comes to you as a kid, you mm-hmm. wanted a career in music, you wanted a career in marching yeah. band. That's what you wanted to do ever since the time you were a little bit
marching,
or what?
I wanted to be a band director. And
you knew that as of what age, Arthur?
I think around 13. Uh-huh. That was my goal. My brother was a musician, and I was in a school band and idolized my band director, Jerry St. Amon, and wanted to be like him. Wound up student teaching under him and teaching back at my junior high school alma mater, then Beauregard Junior High. Mm-hmm. And eventually I wound up as band director, Brother Martin, for 16 years. But no, I knew what I wanted to do. And at that point, it wasn't Mardi Gras, but it sort of was a hobby developed into a business.
Can I ask you a dumb question, which is, how do you go about as a band director deciding who marches where to form what?
Oh, in terms of the band formation?
Yeah, like at halftime, if you want to spell out something or along those lines, the famous script Ohio, how do you go about even designing all of that?
No, well, it's pretty complicated. Unfortunately, my co-band director, Marty Hurley, who sadly passed away about 8 years ago, was in charge of that, was an absolute expert at it. So I didn't have to know how to do it. I was smart enough to hire somebody who did. But it is complicated. And speaking of how do you make decisions, any decent high school band gets invitations to virtually every parade, and you do get a stipend to march in a parade. You're paid. Mm-hmm. The band is paid. Not the band, but the school. Mm-hmm. And that was always a tough decision. So I've asked Marty Hurley, my assistant, you make those decisions because every crew in town is going to lean on me. Hey, I'll give you information for your magazine if you march in my parade. No, mm-hmm. we don't do that. But that's a tough call because you want to go where the kids will be seen by the most people. It's a great recruiting tool, So do you do one parade in St. Tammany, one in the West Bank? Well, how do you make those decisions? And fortunately, again, I didn't have to worry about that.
You know, I never thought about it as a recruiting tool until you said that, but I guess that's the best way to advertise a school to a lot of people, huh?
Yeah, more people see you one parade than 1,000 football games, you know, and and every block is a different audience, so you need to be sharp throughout the parade. And, of course, the minute you finish playing the song, the next block, hey, come y'all, don't play nothing.
Right,
play
exactly.
You
can't
play
constantly. You can't do it all the time. How do you decide, since we're talking about band and that was an important part of your life, how do y'all decide when to play?
Well, normally, of course, by reviewing stands, you know, Gallagher Hall, things like that. But wherever you think the audience is, the crowd's big. Major intersections, maybe a little bit in the formation area and a little bit at the end. But you try to space it out. I never counted how many times we played in a, you know, let's say a 5-mile parade. But it was a bunch. But, you know, the fatigue factor is you got to save the kids. You know, you can always tell the out-of-town bands. Because in the first two blocks, they let it all out, and then they got nothing left. Our parades are long. You know, Macy's, Rose Parade are a mile and a half. And bands that come down here, and after the third of the parade, they're ready to get back on the bus. But the bus isn't there. It's at the end of the route, so you got to go 2 more hours.
Do you go in with a playlist?
Oh, yeah. We at Brother Martin, we always memorize. It made the students memorize. You don't have to carry, you know, sheet music in the footfold or anything. Mm-hmm. So we had maybe 6 or 7 tunes, and we'd alternate them, you know. But I still miss that. I still have my hand in a little bit. But those great days, and I enjoyed walking with the band. You got to see so many people at street level, you know, and most people were complimentary. Some would tell you that their band is better, and maybe it was. I don't know.
So when you were marching in a Mardi Gras parade, is that what really turned you on to Mardi Gras, or were you a big Mardi Gras fan before?
Oh, no, I was always a Mardi Gras fan. Any kid in New Orleans, you know. And, again, I marched in my first parade when I was 13 years old. And the side note there, my band director, Jerry St. Amand, I wasn't that good. And so he knew I wanted to march. So although I was in the band, I didn't march with my trumpet. He let me carry the American flag, which I thought was very, very kind.
Wait a minute, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely.
I'd have let you march with the trumpet. I just wouldn't let you play.
Yeah, well, you know, band writers tell stories about taking kids' mouthpieces right before the parade. I can't find my mouth. Oh, it's all right. Just carry it on.
Just carry it. You'll be fine. Just hold it up to your mouth. Nobody will know.
But I thought about it.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk about, first of all, somebody texted in. Congratulations. Somebody else texted in. Wants to know, Mardi Gras Guide is going to go on, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And will you have any hand in it at all, consulting?
We're talking about that.
Okay. All right, we'll take a break, pick it up with Arthur Harding when we come back. Y'all got any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Stepping down, and that's going to be a bittersweet moment for him, man, when the police come down, or I guess when Rex meets Comus for him, and he realizes that that's it. No more Mardi Gras guy. Won't have to start preparing on Ash Wednesday. He'll be able to head off to Oslo, Norway. 920, more in a flash, WWL. October, but it still seems good to hear. It sounds good to hear it. Arthur.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And you're seeing exactly the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos. Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hardy is our guest. He announced his retirement, and not yet. He's going to be around through midnight Mardi Gras this year.
Yeah.
Arthur, where did the Yeah, news of his death has been greatly exaggerated, right?
Yeah, Mark
he's not
point.
Dying. He's not gone anywhere. Arthur's retiring, unlike me. I want to die behind this microphone. Ideally, Arthur, I would say, all right, Newell, we'll be listening. And then my head hits the microphone, and that's it. Lights out.
One way to go, huh?
Yes, exactly. Where did the no worries about retirement or anything else. Tell me about the idea for the guide. Where did that come from? Because I don't think people today, I think today people take a lot of things for granted. And they don't realize back in the day, you had no idea. There's no Mardi Gras hotline you call. No crew has a number listed. So if you were wondering, is the parade going to roll? Is it not going to roll? Blah, blah, blah. Tell me about it.
Well, when I was at Loyola University, I had a part-time job answering the phones at WSMB Radio. In fact, I stayed on there part-time well into the early 1980s, even when I was teaching. And each Mardi Gras season, people would call, well, can you tell me about the parade? So every morning, I would get the newspaper, cut out all the parade maps, put it on one sheet to give the announcers. And it occurred to me, you know, you got like TV Guide to lay out a week's worth of television doing one out of Mardi Gras. Nobody had thought of it. It was a simple idea. But
do you remember the moment you thought of that? Was it like light bulb went off? Was like
No. It
was an evolution?
It developed over time, you know, yeah. But it just it seemed like such a simple idea, and that wasn't simple to pull off, but it was an easy idea, and an easy idea to, you know, have in your head, but okay, now what do we do, Coach? You couldn't look up the crew of Endymion in a phone book and get Ed Muniz's phone number. You know?
Right.
So it took some time and effort, and the business really was a financial failure for the first 4 years, but we stuck with it. But obviously there was a need for it, and now, I mean, information is available everywhere, and that's why the magazine has to have more than just maps in it. We expanded it to, you know, have a lot of stories in it. And I mean, my goal always was for somebody – well, if they're not from here, that the magazine would tell them, you know, in capsule form what they need to know. But if you are from here, that you pick it up and say, man, you remember this? I hadn't thought about this in 20 years more. I've been here my whole life and I didn't know this. You know, so kind of two different target audiences, I guess, in terms of what does the magazine bring to you that you wouldn't have had if you hadn't bought it at K&B. Remember K&B? That was my biggest outlet. Ain't there no more.
Got any ice cream. Somebody texted in and said, I have all the Mardi Gras guide issues. Thanks for what you did for Mardi Gras. Mardi Gras Mike, I know a lot of people after Katrina and some of the other floods that happened were upset because they lost their past copies, back copies of the Mardi Gras guide. Are back issues still available if somebody wanted all 50 of them, Arthur?
No, not really. And a couple of years, I don't have more than five or six myself. You know, the first year we did 5,000 copies. Yeah, I don't have. I mean, I have all of them, but not like, you know, 20 of each year or anything.
Yeah.
But okay. The first year we did 5,000 copies, and we only sold 1,500. Mm. And I burned them, the best of them, except for a few, never knowing that it, I didn't even know if there'd be a second one, let alone, you know, keep
had
going.
No idea, because now, boy, people would be clamoring for those.
Yeah, I'd like to have some myself. You know, a handful. But in the second year, 1978, we did 5,000 again, and we sold them almost all. I mean, like all but 100. So then we figured, all right, we're going to roll the dice and do 10,000 in 1979, and that was a police strike. So we didn't sell hardly any. We burned some more copies. So it was a critical
situation. You're hoping for a cold winter. Hoping for a cold March. Let's hope we got some cold fronts coming through in March because we get some guides to burn, right?
I mean, you know, I laugh now, but I wasn't laughing then.
No, I bet you weren't.
My wife said, you know, we were more stubborn than smart.
So let me ask you this. In the 50 years you've been doing this, what are some of the more substantial changes in Mardi Gras that you've seen?
Oh, God. And we will cover this in the magazine this year. I mean, certainly the growth. I mean, in 1977, Endymion had 700 members. Now you've got 15 clubs with 1,000 members. Endymion, 3,300. Iris, that's the other big change. The women have taken over Mardi Gras. Iris has
largest crew, right?
Members. Yeah. We have number one. Cleopatra's above 2,000, so is Femme Fatale. I mean, it's Mardi Gras is much more diverse now, more opportunity for people. The addition of the alternative parades, Chewbacca's, Crew de Vu, and then the female walking groups and rolling alibi. None of that was there in 1977. The biggest thing is no more neighborhood parades. We had parades in probably 12 different neighborhoods in 1977. Mm-hmm. Now everybody wants to be in the St. Charles Avenue run, you know, so it's changed. It's grown. It's never been bigger. It may be getting too big. That's my big concern right now, is how much is too much. We have to be careful. We don't overdo it.
I know people in Allen. I knew once they went to St. Charles, they were not going back to DeGaulle and Berman Highway. No disrespect to DeGaulle and Berman Highway, but
no, I'm with you. Yeah, the audience has changed, and you either move or you perish. St. Bernard lost, I think, 18 parades. Mm-hmm. Now they have only one. Just through the years, you know, people's tastes change. They what they want to see, and we've become so jaded with throws. Now we used to be happy to get couple of doubloons and some.
Yeah,
beads,
I'm going to get to that in a second. Nantok will never leave Algiers, though, do you think?
Oh, no. The pride of Algiers? Hell no. No, they're there forever. God bless them.
And do you see ever, like, Mardi Gras returning to Gretna? Or I guess they have one parade in St. Bernard now. Is that right?
Yes, they do on the first Saturday, Nemesis, yeah. Well, anything can change. I mean, who mm-hmm. would have predicted all the changes that have happened? I don't know. But, again, St. Charles Avenue is and Canal Street, for Endymion, seem to be where the parades want to be. And who can blame them, you know, to parade under 200-year-old oak trees? It's
all right, Arthur, we lost Arthur Hardy, so let's take a break here, 9:32, 28 till 10. We'll look at traffic, then we'll try to reconnect with Arthur when we come back on WWL. 9:38, 22 till 10, back with Arthur Hardy, who is retiring on Ash Wednesday, right at midnight, I guess, at Mardi Gras, and he is the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. We're just kind of finding out a little bit about him. Everybody has a story, and we're hearing his. Arthur, when it comes to Mardi Gras, and I'm going to bring up three very controversial words, Dorothy okay. Mae Taylor, and Lord mm-hmm. knows if you were here during that period how what's the word I'm thinking of? Disruptive it was, but disruptive doesn't necessarily have to be a bad word. Would Mardi Gras be where it is today when you look at all the parades during the week, if not for Dorothy Mae Taylor, if the old line crews had not made way for some of the crews that replaced them? Arthur? All right. Arthur dropped out again. So apparently somebody jamming his signal. To make sure, we'll try to wait to see if he. But Dorothy Mae Taylor, for those of you that don't know, she, back in 1992, she, and I'm going to try to encapsulate this as accurately as I can and as briefly as I can. Basically, she was saying that if crews used public streets, then they had to open themselves up to the general public, or at least open themselves up to people of different races and not discriminate. So, because you can still, an organization can still pick and choose who joins, so long as it's not based on race, as I understand it. So Arthur Hardy's back. Arthur, Dorothy Mae Taylor, would Mardi Gras be where it was today without her?
Oh, I think so. I think so. Integration was happening anyway.
Okay.
It may have accelerated it a little bit. But, you know, look at where it is today. And if, I guess if people want to give her credit for speeding up the process, then that's fine. But, I mean, there's a place for everybody now in Mardi Gras. Not everybody can do everything. But if you can't find a spot, you're not trying. Now, obviously, it costs money, you know. But I've been getting texts on my phone.
Wait, if you can't find a spot to ride, not a spot to start
exactly,
a parade.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
A couple of texts I got. The Mardi Gras will be out right before Christmas. And the Picayune's doing a hardcover coffee table book with all 50 of our back issue covers.
Oh, awesome.
And a highlight from each year that I've written, and more than 200 photos. So that's going to be available at NOLA.com. And what I'm really excited about, in addition to that, WYS is planning a 30-minute documentary on my 50 years in the business. Dennis Walton's going to do it, if they can get the funding. You know, they've lost all kind of federal funding. So mm-hmm. I'll be out in the corner shaking cans trying to get supporters for our documentary.
But would you have any? Would you consider any kind of GoFundMe thing or anything like that?
Oh, no, no. They can't. PBS can't do that, no.
Oh,
and I'm joking. I'm sure the money's going to come in. But, I love YES and been doing Stepping Out with Errol and
Thank you. Stefano, Carnival Time since 1987. Every year we do a little preview of the season, and that will continue. I want to do that. It's so much fun, and they're so knowledgeable and such good people. And in fact, you were MC this year when Peggy got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the Press Club. So we all go back a long way, don't we?
Yeah, I that's right. I did MC that event. When it comes to differences in throws, you started to talk about this earlier, and I know just having written a little bit of time that I did. Back in the day, man, as a kid watching a parade, you'd grab any kind of bead you could, doubloons, whatever. Now, unless it's they're very selective about what they'll even bend over to pick up. Talk about that, if you will, the changes in the throws and so forth.
We've become spoiled and jaded, you know, and that's why so many beads and even doubloons are winding up in the catch basins. People won't even bend over to pick them up. And, you know, you don't. Well, I wish you went to Mardi Gras parade for more than throws, but it's become an important part. And in fact, one of the first things that the Mardi Gras guy did that was different was we were the first to ever publish what the crews were going to throw. The newspaper did not do that. There was no interest, I guess, in it. And that became one of the selling points, is you'll not only know the theme, but what you're going to catch. Mm-hmm. But it's a monster now, and the budgets for throws, I mean, we both know many people who ride in parades. I don't know anybody who spends less than a grand on things to give away to people we don't even know. You know,
that'd be a bare minimum, $1,000. That'd be a bare minimum, $1,000. I don't think that would get you started even. Arthur, when it comes to
– first 6 blocks.
exactly. When it comes to the balloons, are they still popular or not?
Well, they made a little bit of a comeback, but not what they once were. And I always thought it was the perfect throw, you know, because it's inexpensive. It'll last for 1,000 years. It says I was at this parade. You've got the date, the theme, the logo. But again, it doesn't sing and dance and make breakfast for you. So it's not as attractive as it once was.
And along those lines, real quick, where are we going with that? Because it seems like they're going from stuff you can't use to stuff that they want you to take home and use, and I guess they promote security, right?
Yeah, locally sourced throws that are environmentally friendly. There's been a big push towards that. And I have to admit, I was wrong. I thought this movement would never take off, but it has. Now, it still isn't the majority of throws aren't that way, but I'm glad to see it. I think it's healthy, and you know, who knows what innovator will come up with something new. And it's such a big business, and one of the unique things about this is that, you know, you don't need – it's not like the Olympics where you have to get an official license or something. You come up with a good idea, you do it. I mean, it's entrepreneurship at its best, and no official products, no advertising. Nobody does anything like this. Think of any sporting event. It's always brought to you by some company, you know. The citizens are the company that produced Mardi Gras, you know, and it's – very unique celebration.
Greatest free show on earth for anybody but those riding. Real quick, you know, get back to Dorothy May Taylor for a second. You mentioned it about it takes money, and I think there was a lapse after that where there might have been a void for parades, and then the vacuum was filled. But one thing that did come out of that was that it takes money to produce a parade, and it is not the greatest free show on earth. When it comes to funding for parades, I know at one point the crews had said that the casinos hurt them because it took away their bingos, et cetera.
Right.
What are you hearing about funding for parades now for crews and organizations?
Well, there's some concern about the tariffs, what's that going to do to the cost of throws. Mm-hmm. But generally, dues and throw sales are what finance the Mardi Gras crews. And I don't see that changing. Insurance is another real cost that crews have to deal with. You know, you talked about crews coming in and filling the void. Mm-hmm. Since 1977, there have been 76 parades that have gone out of business. 76.
Wow.
So, but they're replaced by other crews, you know. So the cycle continues, you know. I don't think it's ever going to compress significantly. Got more than 50 parades in the three parish area. It might go down to 47. It's not going to go up to 60. But I think we're about as big as we can be. You mentioned ALA, which they moved to St. Charles Avenue, but they were finishing at 1 o'clock in the morning because they were the third of a triple header. Well, that problem's been solved. They moved into the spot Knicks had on Wednesday night following the Druids. And now we're hearing that the Thursday night, where Muses have been finishing late, the parades are going to start an hour earlier, and that's not definite yet. That's coming before the council next week. So an earlier starting time will get parades theoretically off the street if you don't have a breakdown.
Right? We got to go, but I ask you real quick, 30 seconds left. Last year we started Mardi Gras early because of the rain, and it seems as though everybody embraced it. No chance we go back to that, huh?
Oh, no, I don't think so. No, okay. No, that was a one-off.
I liked it better. Thank you, Arthur. I appreciate it. Have a good time. I know you're not going away because we'll talk to you during Mardi Gras.
Absolutely. You count on it.
I'm in. Thank you. All right. Here he is, the man, the myth, the legend, JR. How you doing, JR?
I'm doing outstanding, Tommy. I couldn't be more excited. Got a big, big weekend ahead of us. In fact, we've got our very first game of the month in college football, which, by the way, documented last year, 10 wins, one loss, and a push on our games of the month. So you want to take advantage of these. I'm going to give it out absolutely free via text message. All you got to do, text the word WIN. That's the word WIN, W-I-N, to the number 545454. We're going to give you that game of the month absolutely free. Guys, you know how it is. No strings attached. No hidden kind of nonsense. You just text the word WIN to 545454. We're going to hit you right back and give you that college football game of the month. If you want to get that winning bid, absolutely love it. We believe it to be a blowout winner. So text WIN to 545454.
Your false favorite, your free pick, did pretty good last week.
It did. I told the gentleman off air we had Arizona on Friday night. We came in with Texas A&M, which was a blowout winner favorite on Saturday. I gave you guys on air last week, I think, the Rams, which got the job done. So, yeah, I mean, listen, we only lost that first week with the Pittsburgh Steelers by 1 point against the Jets. But you guys know how it is. The free picks are excellent. We make money on these. You do want to take advantage of them. More importantly, when you contact us and you get a free pick or you sign up for service, that's where the real money is made. So do yourself a favor this week. Take advantage of this huge, I'm telling you, it is an absolute blowout. You get it for free when you text WIN to 545454. Now, I might sound a little off today, Tommy. I woke up, I felt like I got punched in the nose by one of my children yesterday. Uh-oh. I am completely clogged up. The allergies are here, and hoping we can cope.
I got a guy that could help you with that, but I'll tell you about it later. Let me ask you about, we're getting ready to do this thing with my own money, $5,000 of my own money as it relates to bankroll management. I got some stuff going on. We can't start it today. I can't start it next Friday. But because of geofencing, I will start it the following Friday. Tell me about bankroll management. If somebody, hypothetically, like I'm going to do, literally, sign up and deposit, say, $5,000 in an account, how do you go about managing that bankroll for them, JR?
Well, we're going to start you off pretty simple. I don't want to get too complicated when we first get rolling. Mm-hmm. There are more things that we can do later on. Like, I like to change gears depending on the time of year that it is, depending on historically what my record has been during that time of year. And also just the multitude of games we're expecting to bet during each week. So in your case, I'm going to keep it where your risk is going to be less or at 5% to start, since you're only playing with 5,000. We're probably going to start off at about $250 a game, but we'll increase from there. We're looking to get you to, you know, after a certain amount of net wins. And I'll lay this out for you when we, you know, are off air.
Well, no, the reason I'm asking is so people understand what it is, that you're not just giving picks, you're managing a bankroll as well.
I do, and it would take me 15, 20 minutes to lay out the full strategy, but just kind of give you a glimpse. What I like to do when we start off new with somebody brand new, starting with a minimal bankroll, right? We'll go and I'll lay out the first 25 games. I break up that 25 games usually into five sets of five games, okay? The first five games, I just like to keep it simple, bet the same amount on every game, $250. Based on success, okay? If we go a perfect 5-0, I'm going to have you step it up to 500 on the next five games. If we go 4-1, I'm going to have you step it up to 375. Even if we go 3-2, one net win, you're going to go from 250 to 300. Now, if at any point, because we always talk about I'm an ex-fiduciary, you know, I believe
in... Because you're talking about multiples here. You're talking about multiples here is what you're talking about, aren't you?
I sure am, yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Correct. And then also pulling back, right? So if at any point we have two net losses, whether that's back-to-back losses or 1-3 run, we're going to pull it back by a third. So if you're betting, let's say, 750 at the time and we happen to go back-to-back losses, we're going to drop it down to 500. And until we get back those two net losses, back to two net wins, we'll go back to 750. The idea is progression. And once we get to the point where your bankroll, let's say, is back up to 20,000 from 5,000, right? Now you can consistently be betting at least $1,000 a game rather than just 250. And that's
there's
what we're
a
looking
method.
To do. We want to increase.
There's yes. a definite method is what I was trying to get across. It's not just picks.
No. And you look, the picks are great. They really are. And I sometimes don't get that message through. People just don't hear that part of it because I'm so big on strategy. The idea is that, look, there's no one out there that can hit 75% of their games. It does not exist. Okay. Even us last year, we had a phenomenal college basketball season. I hit 65% in college basketball, my top plays for my clients. Right. But you know, you can't plan on that. You can't bank on that. So you got to systematically get yourself in the best position to be able to move your bets up and take advantage and also protect on the way down. I talk about it all the time and you will be a part of it. You'll see for yourself what I do. And you will
I can't
be
wait
able
to get
to,
going.
You know, let people know what's going on. Listen, it's not a get rich quick. I'm not going to make you, you know, your $5,000 into $100,000 in 30 days. It doesn't work.
I understand
like
that. I get that.
It's going to be a slow and steady, you know, race that we're going to get to the finish line. And I'm hoping you're going to buy something nice that you can show off with the money that we make you this year.
You got a free pick for me?
Of course I do. Come on. You think I come without.
Well, I think you got sinus trouble. I didn't know. You had sinus problems. I don't know.
Well, here's what we're doing. Okay. Just like last week. Yes, the Rams were, you know, and have been playing great football. One of the reasons that we used them, but the Titans were terrible. Same thing this week. The Titans, they're not just terrible. I mean, Cam Ward is going to be a serviceable quarterback. He'll probably be pretty darn good, you know, as the years progress and he gets used to the system. But they're still just an overall bad team. Their defense, it's okay, but they seem to really fall off in the second half. The Colts are playing great football. First two games have been, you know, I mean, let's face it, last week they got a lucky win against Denver, a blowout in week number one they had. Daniel Jones looks like he's actually anybody that leaves the Giants go on to do wonderful things. So same thing with the Jets. So I like the Colts this week. It opened at 3.5. It's all the way up to 4.5. Don't wait till game day on this one. It's going to go to 5, maybe 5.5. So take the Colts minus the 4.5. A steamroll game. They absolutely blow out the Titans. I'm looking for them to win this game between 14 and 17 points. Use the Colts as your free game. But guys, let's make money. Okay, what you want to do, text the word win to 545454. We're going to give you our college football game of the month absolutely free. You'll get it via text message. All you got to do, text win, W-I-N, to the number 545454. And as always, I love doing this, Tommy. I can't wait to get your bankroll rolling.
Me too.
Guys, be safe, have fun, and let's go out there and let's make some money.
Thank you, JR.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.